Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Well, on the Media Project this week, we have a lot of interesting topics that we will get to very quickly. Ira Fussfeld, the longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman of Kingston, is right here.
Hello,
next to me.
And Happy New Year.
Sir, you also, absolutely. And Dr. Alan Shartok, CEO of Northeast Public Radio.
Hey, Rexy.
About whom I wish to... Oh, I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, Albany. About whom, Dr. Shartok, I wish to say, you know, you have an interesting, a particular skill, and I've made note of this before, but someone who you were interviewing was pointing this out to me. You're a really great interviewer. Now, I'm not saying this just to butter you up.
Well, certainly not, because it would be entirely uncharacteristic.
Because it wouldn't work.
But it was. You know, actually, last week's show, I was listening to last week's show in which Mike Spain was here in my place, the associate editor of the Times Union, and there was one point where I was wishing that I was here. I was kind of talking back to the radio saying, Mike, say this, say this. And you interjected, you know what Rex would say if he were here. You gave my response for me.
I remember that. Yeah, we've known each other too long.
It was wonderful. Anyway, interviewing is not an easy skill, actually. It's not, among journalists, it is a good talent to have. It is not one of my strong points. And I've asked you about this, how you kind of know easily what the next question is. You don't even think it's a difficult thing.
My view of this, Rex, has always been, as pompously as I can put it, that within every answer that the interviewee gives is the potential for the next question. And if you listen real carefully, they'll lead you, because you'll say, oh, that was interesting. And sometimes they don't say something interesting, so you go back two questions and you say, well, you know, before I was sort of fascinated by the fact that you said. But it's always a question of whether to go, not to go too far, not to alienate them so they either huff or puff or walk out of the room or shut up because they're now angry at you. So it's always a balancing act. It is not, you're too kind with your compliments, but believe me, it has nothing to do with anything except that you're in a conversation with another person.
I often find myself listening enough to the answer that I don't have a good question ready to go next. So I will defensively go, huh. And usually, sometimes that will, or you can say, really? But sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. I remember in my first sit-down interview with Mario Cuomo when he was governor, when I first came up to this community, I got to one of those points where I was just thinking what he had just said, and I was trying to write it down at the same time, and I said, huh. He said, what do you mean by huh? Is that meant to be a question? And, you know, he started to interrogate me
based upon one syllable. Yeah. No, he's very funny. And, you know, there is a big difference between huh and the other utterance. What was the other one you just used?
Really.
Really.
Yeah.
Really connotes, I don't believe you.
Yeah. It can be.
And huh is sort of, you know, oh, I hadn't thought about that.
If you don't have a question ready, I mean, here's a little tip for aspiring journalists. The next question can always be, tell me more about that. That can often get you through.
Well, you know, Larry King, who is not necessarily known for hardball kinds of interviews, but he is generally well regarded for being a good conversationalist, and he will always say, I ask questions that I'm interested in.
I think that's right.
It's just a conversation.
And the real question is, when you ask the question that you're interested in, Are you somehow able to relate that to what the people who are listening might be interested in?
Well, in that regard, Larry King, I recall his first interview with Terry Anderson after his years of captivity, after being the AP bureau chief in the Middle East. Terry Anderson was released. Larry King was interviewing him, and about 10 minutes into the interview, his question was, "What about sex?" So, to what Larry King was clearly interested in, what, wife number six now, and listeners as well, which is why
there's
about
a reason that it's wife number six.
Yeah. Which is why we're about to talk about here the tabloids of New York City and their apparent battle over what Elliot Spitzer did or did not do with a young lady while on vacation in Jamaica.
In the hot tub.
The New York Post had a front page big story alleging that Elliot Spitzer and the political press aide, who is his current romantic interest, Liz,
who was not, by the way, put onto the de Blasio. She ran the de Blasio communication team
during the campaign.
During the campaign, she was nowhere to be seen when he announced his new communications team.
So the Post says that they were in a hot tub. They quoted an unnamed 10-year-old claiming that there was a quote who shouted, "Mom, there's an old guy in the jacuzzi with this girl, and she's topless, and she's got her legs wrapped around him," quote, unquote, an unnamed 10-year-old.
And wasn't there something about toe-sucking?
Supposedly.
Oh, no, that was
yes,
the other thing.
That was what he claimed. That was what the claim was in the hot tub. The New York Daily News comes back the next day saying, the lead is, "This Spitzer story is impossible to swallow. Former Governor Elliot Spitzer and new gal pal Liz Smith celebrated the New Year in Jamaica." And then it goes on and says, yes, they were on a vacation, but they quoted people by name as saying, no, in fact, there was nothing inappropriate about what was going on. And it was actually
And they weren't in the hotel. I think if they checked the
That's
records
right.
at the time that they were supposed to have been involved in this.
They actually had checked out before the alleged
So that's the New York POST that ran the allegation. Here comes the Daily News and says, it isn't true. And then the Daily News says, Rex.
Hot tub tip is for suckers. No, what?
No, I circled it. What's so fascinating about this is that...
The rapidly imploding downmarket New York Post is how
that's
they describe
what the Daily News called them. Yeah.
You know, we all talk about the New York Post and mostly negatively, but it's what's known as a feisty tabloid, and it does these kinds of stories.
Ira, I hope you're not looking for a new job at the New York Post.
No, I'm not looking for any job right now, but I had two things that I noticed about that initial story. One was it related all of this supposedly happened, and then all the way at the bottom it said somebody quoted was saying, no, this is not
this
true.
Didn't happen, right?
And it just struck me as that's not fair. I mean, bring the denials up higher, you can still talk about the rest of it. But secondly, it sounds like, and I hadn't read this Daily News story, that they just made this up out of whole cloth. How could this happen? It just gives us all a bad name.
Well, I just have to say, the Army McCarthy hearings, very few of us are old enough to remember them, in which Mr. Welch turned around and said to McCarthy, "Senator, have you no shame?"
Have you no shame.
The answer is
shame. No.
No.
And by the way, if this was happening in the open at a resort, is it not impossible to believe that somebody would have had a cell phone camera to have taken pictures of this if they were right? They weren't behind any bushes. They were in the swimming pool. Now, the other question is, why is this such interest to anybody?
Well, I happen to be a big defender of Elliot Spitzer's right to have a girlfriend. I mean, for God's sake.
Well, whether or not, you know, the fact is he is now out of public life. It looks like he will never be able to step back into public life now that
he's... Andrew Cuomo is living with a woman he's not married to. I think it's terrific, by the way. I don't in any way think there's anything wrong with it. But why are we so obsessed with Elliot Spitzer? Oh, I get these letters because he broke the law, because he did this or not. But he really is the object of so much anger out there. It's entirely inappropriate. And I want you to know I wrote that in the paper.
Uh-huh.
And guess who I heard from?
Uh-huh. Anthony Weiner?
No, I heard from her, from Liz.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah,
really?
She wrote and said, thank you.
Well.
And I wrote back and said, you know, you're welcome. I'm very angry about this. I really think that it's crazy that of all the people, Spitzer has become the butt of it. Well, everybody else, and I think it's fine, are going around and doing their thing and having a right to a second marriage or a second girlfriend. It's just crazy.
A lot of this, of course, comes through the unusual approach to journalism taken by various Fox properties.
Which is owned by the same company that owns the New York Post.
New York Post, Fox News, and there is now a bit of very interesting point-counterpoint going on involving Roger Ailes, the CEO of Fox News, former political operative. He was a professional political consultant who then turned himself into a network executive. And there is now a new book that has been published called The Loudest Voice in the Room, a 560-page biography of Mr. Ailes.
A big book for
a big guy.
Over 100 pages of that 560 bibliography.
Notes.
Yeah. Details, absolutely. It's published by Random House.
And Random House is because they're anticipating legal stuff.
Well, that is, in fact, the case. Gabriel Sherman, the author, had everything vetted, of course, before Random House would publish. I'm sure this was carefully vetted. Notwithstanding that, Fox News has set up an entire war room to attack this.
Which is only helping sales of the book,
well,
of course.
Absolutely. What is also interesting is that now, you know, Fox News has its own press critic.
Howie Kurtz.
Kurtz,
yes.
Formerly of Washington Post and
Howard
CNN.
Howard Kurtz went from the Post to the Post?
Yes.
He was in CNN at the same time as he was at the Washington
Giving
Post.
Giving new meaning to the word selling out.
Well, the interesting thing is that he sent out a tweet, I believe, which takes readers on this issue to the Fox News site, not to the actual book site itself. So all of Fox News is aligned on how to defend
His case is very interesting, and we can get back to this book, but Kurtz is very well respected as a media critic for the Washington Post. And then he went, at the same time he was at the Washington Post, he went to CNN, and he was hosting a weekly media program, similar to this one, except an hour. And then he left the Washington Post, got involved with, I believe it was the Daily Beast, I'm not sure which, but there was a somewhat of a controversy regarding him because he started to get careless with facts. Mm-hmm. He is now, subsequently, has moved within the last 3 or 4 months from CNN to Fox News, where he does the same type of program. What I have detected, and I watched the old program, I still watch the new program.
God, Harry, you watch everything.
I watch what I think is important, and I believe you can see the slant in his new program that was not evident on CNN. More of his guests on the new program are Fox-related correspondents. I just detect something that I never saw before. He is still a little bit more moderate than the average Fox News person, but I do see a distinction over there. And you have to go back to the book that this is the brand that Roger Ailes has established.
Well, it certainly is. So you don't know if he got hired by Fox because he was willing to reflect this or if it just rubs off. And once you go to work for the company, things change.
But here is Ailes, who is one of the more controversial figures in our politics. There are many people who really can't stand the guy. And the book is obviously a gutsy book to put out, and a lot of people are going to buy it. And you wonder whether Fox doesn't understand, as I said before, that, my God, the more you fight this, the more you yell about it, the better it is for the book and for the author and for the publisher.
But let me ask you guys this. The lead paragraph in the New York Times describing the book says that Ailes was so eager to influence national politics in the run-up to the presidential election, he told fellow Fox News executives, quote, I want to elect the next president. Now, there is a history in journalism, William Randolph Hearst, a.k.a. Citizen Kane, and others, who have done this. It's part of the glorious or not so glorious tradition of some journalism in this country. So I'm not so sure I'm ready to be critical of him for that if that's what his goal is.
Why? What gets me
about it is they purport to be fair and balanced.
They're portraying
themselves as something they're not. Yeah. If Roger Ailes said, we are the right wing news channel, we want to get right wing people elected, there'd be a place for him on the dial. It probably wouldn't hurt his viewership.
But how about a news director? News director, where is the impartiality of the whole thing?
The fact is that we went through a 50-year period in American journalism with an attempt to have straightforward and fair reporting, where this kind of advocacy journalism was not a part of the mainstream.
Yes.
And it was Fox News that introduced it, or say reintroduced it.
Reintroduced it.
You're right. Certainly William Randolph Hearst, Joe Pulitzer, the press titans Titans of the past mm-hmm. were people who entered the field specifically because they had political allegiances.
Well, I mean, in the old days, you'd say you'd want the newspaper publisher was someone who wanted that power in the community. He owned the press.
The time that I became a newspaper editor, my first editorship when I was very young was in the mid-70s in Indiana, and Indiana had an organization called IREA, the Indiana Republican Editorial Association, and IDEA, the Indiana Democratic Editorial Association.
So this is one of the famous councils. You could bring your objections to the group, right?
You would go to your group. You would have a convention each year, and the politicians from that party would speak to the editors. It was like giving them the indoctrination points.
I started working at the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York in 1970, and I'm told that in the either early 60s or late 50s, the chairman of the Kingston City Republican Party was also the city editor of the Daily Freeman.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of thing was going on.
The legendary Bob Green, whom I worked for at Newsday, winner of two Pulitzer Prizes, one of the great investigative journalists of our time, Bob Green in the 50s was working as a reporter in northern New Jersey. And at night, his second job, to put a little extra money on the table, was writing speeches and position papers and brochures for candidates.
Well,
that was considered appropriate in those days.
Rex, this is a terribly controversial book. I think it's appropriate to have it. There's one point at which he has a woman testifying that she wanted some more money, and he said, I'll give you $100 a week more if you'll have sex with me anytime I want it. You know, this is the kind of thing that doesn't paint a particularly attractive picture of him. By the way, Rex, I wanted to give you a heads up and a real kudo, because there is a piece that has now hit the wires from WikiLeaks, which says that ProPublica and the Albany Times Union started the anti-fracking movement because of the series that you guys ran on this. Could you tell us a little about that?
Back in 2008, we were the first newspaper to publish an article written by ProPublica, the now powerful Pulitzer Prize-winning not-for-profit investigative newsroom. And that piece did raise questions about horizontal hydrofracking in mining, questions that hadn't been raised before. And as I understand it, these documents revealed by WikiLeaks include some files from Stratfor, which is based in Austin, Texas. It's a global intelligence company. And they took a look at fracking and concluded that it was not a controversial issue until mid-2008, when ProPublica Stories and the Albany Times Union, and then reprinted elsewhere, detailed researcher and activist reports of potential water contamination and carried the message that it was a problem. So there we are. Of course, many people are
saying
about it.
That's what's interesting.
Yeah, interesting.
Look, there's been a lot said. There are some very powerful people opposed to it now. I think Andrew Cuomo is staying so far away from it in New York State for a reason, because it has become the issue amongst a liberal constituency who are just, you know, one of the things that is so fascinating to me is how a single issue, nobody knows it's there, and then all of a sudden Yoko Ono comes along and Mark Ruffalo and Natalie Merchant and others, and it really coalesces, and now, you know, it is a real problem for the governor.
Correct me if I'm wrong, he did not mention it at all in his State of the State.
I don't think he did.
It's did lost. Not come up.
It's lost. It's somewhere, as you all remember. First, he seemed to be for it. Then, when the clamor started, he didn't, I think, I'm not in his brain, know what to do about it, and he gave it to the DEC to study. And some say to death. And then the DEC was done, and they gave it to the health department, and where it resides right now, still being studied. And you can study it for all you want, but nobody's going to prove to me or to a lot of other people that it's safe for our water.
And this is an election year, so it's likely not to be resolved before.
Are you suggesting that this governor, because there are other anti-fracking people who think that he's waiting till after the election and then he's going to do something? I can't believe
that. All of this underscores one of the fallacies of the critique of contemporary journalism. When people say, just report the facts, just tell me what happened and I leave the rest to me. You know, we're not for this fine ProPublica reporter Abram Lustgarten, who wrote this piece that we published, we wouldn't have the questions raised about fracking, perhaps, that have been raised today if it weren't for reporters continuing to raise the issue now and citizens who are doing demonstrations and so on. As we can see, the governor himself wouldn't be talking about it. So you need aggressive journalism that raises questions even when public officials don't.
By the way, in the governor's State of the State, he or somebody very close to him is reading a lot of newspapers, because he made a, I think, think, about a half a dozen references to articles that he read in the newspaper, including the
article I read in the newspaper.
And in the New York Times regarding the anti-Semitism in Pine Bush. But he had a slideshow with his presentation using newspaper headlines for his benefit or
how many
to
people
make a
worked on that State of the State?
Yeah.
There must have been a war room of people. But, you know, you're right. I know a little bit about Andrew Goldman. I know he reads. But I think we should tell everybody out there that each of the conferences, the legislative conferences, the Democrats in the Assembly, the Republicans, they all have what are called the clips. And the clips come around, and what they do is they give you every article every day. And they employ a lot of people. I'm sure that there are several people employed for each of these conferences putting the same group of articles
together. Well, you know, they probably don't need to do that anymore because there are the digital aggregation services.
Yeah.
You know, we do a morning newsletter, so does City and State from downstate, and now the ProPublica offshoot called Capital New York.
But Rexy, the difference is Politico, but
right.
they do selected stuff, which a lot of people will be interested in. They don't do everything.
Yeah.
I guarantee you that the clips have everything that has been, if a Republican assemblyman is mentioned, it's going to show up in the clips. One story I can tell you is that I was writing critically about Warren Anderson, the late majority leader in the New York State Senate. And somebody came up to me and said, by the way, you've been excluded from the clips. You're being punished.
The senator will not read your words anymore. So there. If you're just joining us, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio in Albany. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. Ira Fussfeld is here from the Daily Freeman in Kingston, and Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. One of the interesting things that is developing with the new media ecosystem is what is interestingly being referred to as the personal brand journalism. This arises with the pending announcement, almost certainly, that Ezra Klein is going to be leaving the Washington Post. He's the leader of something called Wonk Blog that is widely read and has a significant presence. Nate Silver, he of 538.com, left the New York Times. There are these people whose brands are bigger than the people they write for. Glenn Greenwald, the guy who broke the Snowden story,
right,
you know.
Guardian?
Yes, it was. And more recently, Kara Swisher and Walt Mossberg, who ran All Things D, which was all the digital stuff, extremely influential in the digital and technology world, have left the Wall Street Journal to do their own thing. It is just an interesting development when personalities... But I wonder how different this is from CBS News was made by Edward R. Murrow, right?
Without question.
But Edward R. Murrow needed CBS News to have a place to speak. And Ezra Klein needed a newspaper in which his words could be read. And now the digital technology allows you to just open up your own shop. And it's a lot cheaper to do it. It's extremely inexpensive to do it, at least in terms of disseminating the information. What is still expensive, particularly on your own time. I mean, will Ezra Klein, who wants to, by one account, spend $10 million to form whatever it is he's trying to form, is there $10 million in revenue?
Well, Ira, far be it from me to disagree with you ever. But the truth of the matter is, I don't agree.
I think
you still need a major outlet.
Well, you didn't let me finish the point.
I didn't know that you were going to.
Yeah, no, I think that it's one thing to establish the brand, and it's easy to establish the brand, but can you sustain the brand without the backing of a large company that is drawing people not only to your place in the paper or to the radio show, but a lot of others? I read that Andrew Sullivan, the conservative, was supposedly the first one to have done something like this and is in fact generating a certain amount of money, but it didn't sound like a huge amount of money.
Not enough to sustain.
I have seen people start these things, they leave major newspapers, they say, okay, we're going to do it ourselves, we're going to be great investigative reporters. They're not great investigative reporters. And what happens is, little after they don't produce, they're gone. It's over. So I think if you leave the New York Times, you better think twice. Or if you leave the Albany Times Union, you better think twice before you go and do this.
But in the meantime, it is possible for a superstar journalist to leave a big publication and hurt that publication by his or her absence. Mm-hmm. And their brand is weakened. Your brand has still not been built up. And how is this going to be sustained for either over the long period
of time? Well, it's true. It's sort of mutual destruction. But I have to tell you, I think a lot of people make a lot of mistakes.
It's interesting. We recall the days when great columnists would move from one paper to another.
Yeah.
When I was
Murray
Kempton left the New York Post and went to Newsday. Similarly, Jimmy Breslin left the New York Daily News, went to New York Newsday.
He was at all the tabloids.
Sooner or later.
Yep, that's right. What goes around eventually comes around.
But we, the three of us, are loyal to our particular.
We are loyal. Be true to your school, you know? All right, that's all for the
Although
Media Project
this week. Although I have to say, in parting, I was never a big Larry King fan.
Larry King?
Yes.
Well, he was a long time ago in this program. We've passed.
I've been waiting to say it
for the
whole program.
All right. We'll see you next week, folks.
Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspaper men meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk, hold the press, hold the press.